Give me 2 eggs. So tomorrow I got nothing.
Do you believe that everybody should be born poor 1 week of their life? 1 week.
As you see, I'm in a wheelchair. I was hit by a train 10 years ago. And a year ago, I was hit by a truck.
There's a feeling in the pit of your stomach the first several nights that you're out there when you realize you actually are in a place where you got nowhere to go.
How do you like being at the shelter?
Kind of good. And I like it when we had our own bed, different. And when we get our new house, I'll be so happy when I have my own room.
This may surprise a lot of people, but in the last school year, all of our schools here in Butte County, there's 14 different school districts, identified about 900 students, children and youth who were in homeless situations during the course of the school year.
Welcome to the Without a Roof program, where we expose and remedy poverty, the worst form of violence.
Guillermo Mash here for the May 31st Without a Roof radio program. Want to let our listeners know we can be found on Facebook and YouTube, as well as our homepage, which connects you to all our social media. And we're at woaroof.tumblr.com, celebrating 5 years of economic justice. A couple of Ford promos. We're doing a long form 20-minute interview or so that will air this Friday on The Chico Vibe. It's a new arts and news magazine that airs 6 to 7 on Fridays here at KZFR. And we will be interviewing Laura Kutsuner, the executive director of the Jesus Center, which provides a myriad of services for folks experiencing homelessness and poverty. And the basis of this conversation is going to be around what plans are being implemented right now at the Jesus Center, what are some of the midterm plans, and what's some of the long-term strategy of what the Jesus Center is looking to do with the burgeoning homeless situation here in Chico. And yeah, I'm really interested to see what Laura Kutsuner has to say around that. Start our show here today with Shahara Hyatt, Project Director of the California Homeless Youth Project, who is going to give us some insights on this ending or month ending of the foster care awareness month. And she's also going to give us some color around a very poignant article in the SF Chronicle about the situation with group homes in California and the foster care system. And our last segment of the program is put together by Jess Candela, the facilitator of the Butte County Youth Advisory Council. Includes interviews with Jennifer Barzi, the project director at Sixth Street Center for Youth. And she also interviews at the end of that segment one of the youth that actually participate in the Youth Advisory Council. So with no further ado, thank you for listening to KZFR 90.1 FM, People Power Radio. Man with Mash for the May 31st Without a Roof radio program. And I'm pleased to have Shahara Hyatt, the project director for the California Homeless Youth Project, on the phone. Welcome, as always, to KZFR, Shahara Hyatt.
Hey, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. So today's the last day, quote unquote, the last day. May is National Foster Care Month. Maybe a little bit of words around Foster Care Month and maybe some of the programs or messaging the California Homeless Youth Project's done around that.
So we know there's a really big overlap between young people who are in foster care and people who experience homelessness. So even though foster care has extended to age 21 in California, we know that it's not really serving as many people as could benefit from it, and that a lot of people, young adults, when they age out at 18 or 21, they're still left without a place to stay and without the kind of economic or social, you know, safety net necessary to be successful. So some of the things that we've done around it, we're focusing a lot on college students right now, and a lot of the colleges across the country and in California have more robust programming for foster students. So one thing people might not know is that if you have been in foster care, you're eligible for a federal grant to support your college education. And that's in part because we know that a lot of people who have been in foster care have such great barriers to access and to be able to stay in school. So our federal government tries to do some to make it a little bit easier on folks. And we've been trying to make sure that there are people on every campus that, you know, not only are supporting foster students, but also supporting students experiencing homelessness, because there's such a big overlap between those communities.
Yeah, one thing I'll circle back on, because it was, I'm friends with a couple, but I just found out, Shahara, that
you know, they both, quote unquote, are behavioral health clients, and they just had a baby in March, and it was taken from them on Friday and placed in a foster care situation due to, quote unquote, they weren't, you know, capable of taking care of the child themselves. So it's just a sad situation. But I know this isn't the first youth I've kind of heard this story where, you know, they lose custody of their child, you know, and that now we got a 3-month-old in foster care. Maybe talk a little bit about that or some of your experiences with similar circumstances.
One of the things people might not know is that, you know, there are a lot of different reasons a child can be removed from the home in foster care, and neglect is one of the most common, and neglect is often code for poverty. So generally what I would argue as a social worker, as someone with an MSW, is that we should do more to meet the material needs of those families so that they aren't having to put, you know, their child in a neglectful situation because of their lack of resources, rather than removing them from the home and trying to find, you know, families or institutions that would be able to take them, because there's so much harm done when a child or a young person is removed from their home. So, yeah, I think we need to make sure that the family has, you know, more of an economic safety net and has resources to be able to keep families intact.
I think it's a big, it's a huge, huge deal. I think that's the most healthy circumstance, even if it's not perfect. You know, it's definitely the most healthy circumstance is to keep families intact. And by my experience, that's a lot of times, and that's not the first way that they lead. And then the one instance I got involved with someone that actually had retired from that system, she told me flat out after she got acclimated with it, and we were able to get the child back. In this case, she said if the mom wasn't poor, this never would have happened to her. It's exactly what she said. If she could have afforded an attorney, they never would have taken her kid. So, you know, it's just a sad situation driven by poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a nice, not a nice lead. I mean, there's this article that Shahara and I had talked to. For folks just joining, we're talking with Shahara Hyatt, project director, California Homeless Youth Project. But the Chronicle did an investigation, one of the most hard-hitting ones I've seen, and it was titled "Dubious Arrests Damage Lives, How Shelters Criminalize Hundreds of Children." And what I'm going to do with this piece, I'm going to read the first 4 paragraphs. I'm going to read some of this and get some comments from Shahara. But the piece starts off, which was published on May 18th. Once again, that was the SF Chronicle. But it begins, "The offenses begin innocently enough. Kids watching a movie smear cake frosting on each other. A Monopoly game is overturned. A distraught child hurls whatever is within reach, a tissue box, a shoe, a blanket, dominoes, a cell phone. In California shelters for abused and neglected children, these youthful outbursts can become crimes. The instigators of the cake fight are arrested and accused of inciting a mob. The girl who grabbed her stuffed bear and blanket before flinging books is taken into custody for assault. Another girl is booked at juvenile hall for battery after hitting someone with a pack of hot dog buns during a tussle. The county shelters in our nation's largest foster care system are supposed to serve as a refuge for vulnerable children removed from unsafe homes. Instead, they have funneled hundreds of children, some as young as 8 years old, into the criminal justice system for relatively minor incidents, a Chronicle investigation has found." That's just the first 4 paragraphs. Maybe I could stop there and get some words around that.
Yeah, I'm so glad they wrote this piece, because I think people don't realize that, you know, when we put children in institutionalized settings, especially for situations of no fault of their own, that they aren't allowed then to engage in developmentally appropriate behavior, which is to say they aren't allowed to be children. And I can't think of, you know, anybody I know or myself that didn't fight with their brothers and sisters or fight with other young kids, and never once for me or my family did it result in jail time or somebody calling the police. And especially the scenarios they describe, I think it's so inappropriate to ignore even, yeah, the normalcy of that behavior. And then especially for a child in, you know, shelter and foster care, that they have experienced trauma by definition of the fact that they are there. And the way trauma is exhibited for children can look like behavioral issues. And so the way to treat that is not with punitive responses or linking to the juvenile justice system. It's through therapy, through play, through other kinds of normative experiences, socialization, medication even when it's, you know, necessary. But it's a very wrong-headed approach that we need to shift course on.
Well, continue on this article. It's data compiled by the Chronicle show more than 14,000 calls for service to police and sheriff's department in 2015 and 2016 from California's 10 shelter campuses. The majority of those calls, some repeated for the same incident, sought help tracking down foster children who left without permission. But police and sheriff interventions led to at least 485 arrests, citations, and detainment for alleged criminal offenses. In more than 370 instances, foster children were booked at juvenile hall, receiving punishment instead of for the protection of child welfare agents charged with their care and supervision. Most of the arrests stem from damage to shelter property or scuffles with staff or other children that did not cause serious injury. Few involved drugs, robberies, or deadly weapons. Do you have anything you would add to that?
Well, you know, in those kind of situations, when we call the police, you know, as we see too often, it doesn't necessarily make for a safer situation for a lot of children. And that what would be probably much better is to have, you know, a crisis social worker, someone who can, you know, help a young person to de-escalate. I think it's a big issue that we see sometimes with law enforcement, feeling like an inherent power struggle occurs. And with a child, you know, or a teen, it's often kind of a recipe for disaster. And we see that with these statistics.
Yeah, and I know, and it actually continues on some paragraphs down. It says about two-thirds of those bookings, dubious charges were quickly dismissed. Other children spent days to weeks in jail before their cases were thrown out by prosecutors or judges. And there was one in there, Shahara, that talked about a kid that poked one of the case managers with a candy cane and was arrested for assault with a deadly weapon. Okay. And there's one actual foster care agency, I think it was called Mary Graham, that had the preponderance of instances where they were calling the police up to an average nine times a day. And a lot of times they were calling them for kid was kicking and screaming. There was one of them where they arrested a person for, I believe it was assault or some sort of misdemeanor, because the person, the child actually held on to her leg and wouldn't let go. You know,
wow.
Where do you see where we're at with this whole foster care system? Do you see it getting better? Do you see any legislation on the horizon? What's going on there?
I mean, to me, that scenario that you just mentioned just sort of shows that the folks that are working there are not competent to handle their client population. And so I think that probably one of the biggest things that we can do is make sure that the staff that are working in these kinds of facilities are trained and educated and compensated fairly. So a lot of times, you know, you see like a level 12 group home, which is like a high security sort of, you know, facility for youth in foster care, that the frontline workers are making minimum wage and aren't necessarily highly skilled folks. So they're probably out of their depth with a pretty high needs population. If we have the resources built into our systems from our government to be able to pay trained professionals who are working in those settings, we could avoid these calls to the police. And every year, I think there are strides made and attempts made to improve the system for children and young people. It's important to celebrate and recognize that, but also to acknowledge that we have a long way to go.
Do you have any insight on they're trying to move away from that model? Because these group homes are major. They're major facilities, and obviously they're meant to be, you know, temporary until they find placement. I mean, what's your thoughts on, you know, quote unquote, trying to do away with those homes, those big group homes?
Yeah, so our state government is trying to shift away from, you know, group homes or congregate care, institutionalized sort of settings for youth. But the biggest challenge that we have is that there aren't enough families or adults that are willing or able to step up to provide care in a home setting, which is so much more developmentally appropriate. So we're in kind of a tricky situation with that right now. And I think what I was saying is that, you know, we need to make sure that the system is funded well. I think that one of the biggest challenges that I have as a social worker is that when people hear about these abuses, a lot of times they feel like, oh, well, we shouldn't put money into these programs. And I think that the opposite is actually true. We need to make sure that we're investing adequately so that we have educated, trained, skilled, supported staff. I think that, you know, this expose and lots of other research speaks to how dangerous and unconducive, you know, group homes can be for children, but we know that some will still have to remain because their higher needs and need, like, you know, professional assistance, and there won't be families that are willing to step in. So it's kind of a rock and a hard place. And I think that, you know, what I was just saying is that, you know, every year improvements are made, and I think there's more attempts recently to be listening to youth in the foster care system about what they would like to see, and that change needs to come more swiftly for the youth who are currently in care and the ones that are going to be entering.
Yeah, I know there was one segment in there where one of the case managers of, I'm going to say, just to paraphrase it, a better run facility with that the staff was well trained, had asked the officer not to handcuff the youth. Even though the arrest was, you know, some quote-unquote valid, that they asked the officer not to handcuff the youth because he said that's going to stick with this kid for the rest of his life. And they didn't. They walked him out without handcuffs. I mean, he was only like 9 years old. It was like, he's a young kid. It's like, you know, they're going to slap handcuffs on this kid. They said that'll be a marker for him the rest of his life. That'll be something that is going to stick with him. So I just think we need to have better common sense. I mean, you know, what would you say around that for closing comments?
Yeah, that we need to treat young people with love, and that, you know, hurt people hurt people. So when we see kids acting out and young adults acting out, I think that we need to do more to understand the nature and psychology of that kind of behavior and realize that showing love and helping to be supportive, you know, financially and socially in other ways is a much more effective approach than a punitive one any day.
Good evening. This is Jess Candela, the facilitator of the Butte County Youth Advisory Council. Our council serves youth between the ages of 14 and 24 who have experience with foster care, homelessness, incarceration, or poverty. Today on our show, we have two interviews, one with Jennifer Barzi, the program manager of Sixth Street Center for Youth, and a member of the Butte County Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force. And Jennifer will be talking about those two programs as well as the beginning of the Youth Advisory Council. After Jennifer's interview, we have a short interview with Anthony, a member of the Youth Advisory Council, and he'll be talking about his perspective on what youth are facing in our local community. Enjoy. And I'm here with Jennifer Barzi, who's the program manager of Sixth Street Center for Youth, which is part of Youth for Change. Thanks for being on the show, Jennifer.
Thank you.
And so what is the mission of Sixth Street Center for Youth?
So the mission of Sixth Street is to provide a safe place where youth that are experiencing homelessness can come to get the skills and the resources and the opportunities they need to be able to successfully transition into healthy, independent living and adulthood.
Nice. Very cool. And then who does Youth Street serve? Who are the main people?
So Sixth Street serves youth that are between the ages of 14 up to the 25th birthday that are either currently experiencing homelessness or at immediate risk of becoming homeless.
And what kind of programs do you offer? What does a typical day look like at Sixth Street for these youth?
Good question. We have quite a few different services. So our services range from basic needs, such as a safe place, like I mentioned, the ability to take a shower, do some laundry, get some food, to more intensive services. So we have trained staff on site, counselors and case managers that work one-on-one with the youth on really whatever it is that they need. So it could be help finding a job, help finding shelter, you know, going to a doctor, a whole range.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. And how can the community be involved? How can we support Sixth Street and all the great programs that you're doing?
We do take volunteers. So that is one way that people can come and volunteer. We also have ongoing needs for some of those things I mentioned, like the hygiene items, so soaps and shampoos, canned foods for our incentive store. And, of course, financial donations are also appreciated.
And so you at Sixth Street have kind of pioneered this Butte County Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Well, it actually goes back, you know, quite a few years. The really neat thing is there was a Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force in our area, you know, 10-15 years ago that was a local group that realized that we really didn't have any services for homeless youth around here. And they got together and they met regularly, and when a funding source, which was the Mental Health Services Act, became available, they helped get together to apply for it, and Sixth Street actually came out of that group.
Wow.
So very exciting. And then it kind of went away for a while because, the main goal had been accomplished. Mm-hmm. And then now we're realizing, it's time. There's still a lot of needs out there.
Definitely.
For these youth. And so we've come together as a group of different service providers that serve homeless youth and community members as well to reignite the Butte County Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force.
Definitely. And so the Butte County Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force, what organizations are a part of it, and what are the activities that you've done so far?
Sure. So Sixth Street is a part, HEART, the program, is a part, Butte County Office of Education, Stonewall, Juvenile Probation have all participated, and then there's probably some more that I might be forgetting, so sorry if I do. But it's really a collaborative group, and we've done a few things. We did a survey of both community members and service providers and of youth.
Mm-hmm.
We hosted a candlelight vigil in November, and then we've really kind of focused more recently on really helping getting the Youth Advisory Council going and supported.
Definitely. And so that's part of why we're here today. And so how did this idea spring from the task force? What was this part that was so important to have youth voices heard?
Mm-hmm. Well, as a group, we definitely kept coming back to, what we need is youth input, youth voice, youth involvement,
mm-hmm.
And that just was threaded throughout every conversation we had. And so we got real excited thinking about how can we do this, and started talking about, maybe there's a couple youth from Stonewall, a couple youth from Sixth Street, a couple mm-hmm. youth, that School Ties program is working with, and let's create a space for those youth to come together and be able to identify projects and work on them.
Definitely. It's mm-hmm. such a great idea. And what did the task force really envision the advisory council working on? What was they wanted to achieve? What kind of programs and events did you kind of think of this council doing?
I think, we just really wanted there to be a place where youth who have been homeless or in foster care or, faced other life struggles could come together and really develop some leadership skills and take an active part in making a difference in their community and in the lives of other youth.
Mm-hmm, definitely. Such a great goal. Mm-hmm. And last question, why do you think that youth-focused and youth-led initiatives are so vital for these youth?
Well, I'm a believer in the, we shouldn't help people without people being involved philosophy. So, having youth have a say in how services and programs are designed,
mm-hmm.
That are going to be serving youth is critical and really important. And, youth have great ideas. They have a lot of creativity and a lot of energy. And we really need everybody's voices to be at the table. And having youth involved gets other youth involved, too. So it's just a win-win all around.
Definitely. And I've definitely heard that reflected at our Youth Advisory Council meetings, that youth are so excited to have this opportunity to talk and have their voice heard and to really dialogue with community members. So thank you for bringing that about.
Definitely.
All right. Thanks for being on our show today.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Jennifer for that wonderful interview about Sixth Street, the Runaway and Homeless Youth Task Force, and the Butte County Youth Advisory Council. Next, we have an interview with Anthony, a Butte County Youth Advisory Council member. This is Jess Candela with the Butte County Youth Advisory Council, and I'm here with one of its members.
Hello, my name is Anthony Newman. I am 22.
And what's your experience with homelessness, foster care, incarceration, or poverty, Anthony?
At the age of 5, I was in foster care for 1 year.
And has your experience with foster care affected your life at all, and if so, how?
I would say personally, no, it has not experienced my life much because I was at such a young age. compared to now. It was so far in the past, I kind of blocked it out.
Mm-hmm, definitely. And from your perspective, what are youth facing who have experience with homelessness, poverty, foster care, or incarceration in our local community?
I believe, from my perspective, with the exception of foster care, the homelessness, poverty, and incarceration are one big factor that they face mm-hmm. as youth is acceptance. And living in such a society where they're seen as lazy or criminals, I think that the Youth Advisory Council is doing a great job to help with this.
Thank you. Great.
Yeah.
And any other thoughts you'd like to share about your perspective on this or what the Butte County Youth Advisory Council can do or other youth-led initiatives in Butte County?
I just believe that this is a great program that's helping a lot of youth members, and just we need to get the word out there to let other people know about these programs.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Anthony. Thanks to Jennifer and Anthony for those powerful insights about youth homelessness, poverty, incarceration, and foster care in our local area. If you would like to follow our programs and activities, please like us on Facebook at BC Youth Advisory Council. If any youth would like to join our council, our meetings are on the first and third Tuesdays of every month at 6th Street Center for Youth from 3 to 4 p.m. Once again, thanks to Bill Mash for letting us host this program, and have a good evening.
All right, that pretty much wraps the May 31st Without a Roof Radio program. I thank you all for listening and sharing this experience. And be sure to let your friends know that we're on every Wednesday, 5 to 5:30. I also want to put a plug in for the every other year. The HUD does a nationwide county in each county. And it's called the Homeless Point in Time Count and Survey. So not only do we get a head count on folks experiencing homelessness, we ask them some demographics. And this year's survey was extremely well presented, well executed, as well as a point in time. And Butte County just released the results this week. And we are going to be covering those at some level of detail next week on the Without a Roof Radio program. And if you want to access the report itself, it is at buttehomelesscoc.com. Guillermo Mash here, host of the Without a Roof Radio program, which kicks off a trifecta of KZFR Wednesday public affairs programming, airing from 5 to 5:30.
Each week we explore poverty, the worst form of violence, focusing on human beings without a roof. Thanks for listening, and if you have a roof, be grateful. Non-Human Radio, hosted by Jeannie Trezino, talks all things animal rights, bringing you the latest news and interviews with local activists.
Plus book, film, and restaurant reviews and deep discussions of the benefits of veganism.
For humans and non-humans alike, Wednesdays from 5:30 till 6 p.m. The Real Issue, hosted by Sue Hildebrand, digs into topics ranging from elections to environmental protection.
From social justice to economic justice, from the local to the global.
We cover the political part of everything. Wednesdays from 6 to 7 p.m.
Thanks for listening to
Beat the Power Radio.